Hello, my name is Eric Jorgensen from the Maine Humanities Council, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine. This is a presentation from the University of New England's Center for Global Humanities Lecture Series, which each year brings speakers representing the best of the humanities to Portland.
Good evening. Well, David Barash is a professor of psychology at the University of Washington in Seattle. He was one of the early contributors to the growth of sociobiology and continues to conduct occasional field studies of animal behavior, especially the evolution and ecology of social systems among free-living animals. At present, much of his attention is directed to understanding the evolutionary factors that influence human behavior. Since the early 1980s, he has been active in researching, promoting, and practicing the field of peace studies. He is the author and co-author of more than 20 books, including Strange Bedfellows, The Surprising Connection Between Sex, Evolution, and Monogamy, which was, I think, published in 2009 with Judith Eve Lipton, and Natural Selections, Honest Liars, Selfish Altruist, and Other Realities of Evolution, published in 2007, Madame Bovary's Ovaries, A Darwinian Look at Literature, which was published in 2005, and with Nanelle Barash, who is his daughter I just learned today, right? And The Myth of Monogamy, Fidelity and Infidelity in Animals and People, published in 2002, also with Judith Eve Lipton, as well as more than 300 scientific papers and popular articles. Many of you may know him as a regular contributor to the Chronicle Review, which is the magazine of the Chronicle of Higher Education. His ideas are widespread. People pay attention to what he says. So please help me in welcoming Professor David Barash.
Thank you very much, Anwar, and thank you all for being here. And I particularly want to thank Anwar again, Anwar Majid and David Livingston Smith, for inviting me and for all the work that's involved in doing that, and certainly the people at University of New England for sponsoring this kind of thing. I hope I make it worth your while. Actually, after all those nice words, and I can hardly wait to hear what it is I'm going to say. Let me start with a brief warning to you. You may find what I have to say immensely disconcerting. Actually, I'll take that back. It's not what I have to say that you may find disconcerting. You may find the way I say it disconcerting, because I'm not going to use PowerPoint. I'm actually on a PowerPoint boycott that's been going on for a little over a year now. Interestingly, that's the reaction I get from most people. Let me tell you very quickly how this developed. I was invited to give a talk in San Diego to a very large medical meeting there, and like so many other academics, I had essentially my talk on a little flash drive, which was in my pocket while I was eating breakfast before I flew out to San Diego from Seattle, and our cockatoo, who was eating from my shoulder, which she often does, quickly grabbed the flash drive, which has this bright little colored thingy to it, and went waddling off quickly across the table in great triumph. And so I retrieved it, and it looked fine, and I didn't think much of it. Literally, this is the academician's nightmare of sorts, a variant on that very famous experience. So literally, there I was in San Diego giving a lecture in this huge auditorium. There was something like 5,000 to 6,000 people. It was the biggest live lecture I've ever given. And we put the flash drive in literally 5 minutes before I'm supposed to give my talk, just to sort of make sure everything's all right. And sure enough, I found out it wasn't. It didn't work at all. So it was a big gulp on my part, and I proceeded to give the talk, or at least a variant thereof, in the old-fashioned way. And it worked, or at least people were happy about it, and I was happy about it, and I decided that, you know, maybe it's not necessary for everyone to look at the dancing monkeys and the moving things, and And indeed, sometimes I think PowerPoint tends to distract from the actual communicative function of lectures, which should have something to do with communication instead of everyone looking at the screen. So you're not going to be able to look at my every word as I say it, all right? You're going to be stuck with me and whatever it is I have to say. And I guess if it was good enough for Socrates, it's good enough for me. So we'll see how it goes. I don't have the excuse that I did in San Diego. I mean, this was sort of planned that I haven't used PowerPoint in over a year now. So at least not for these kinds of lectures. All right, so with that little warning, I noticed no one got up and left. Actually, when there's a younger student audience, people are really surprised. I'm not sure they're upset, but they're truly surprised. And for some of them, it's literally the first lecture they've ever been to without a PowerPoint. Anyhow, so what I'd like you to do is to picture this for beginnings. Imagine this was PowerPoint, and you could see it, or close your eyes, if you will. All right, it had been the world's first murder, okay? The ape man who was responsible, actually probably some sort of Australopithecine, had just killed another Australopithecine. He triumphantly throws the murder weapon, a club, which is actually the thigh bone of a zebra, of an extinct zebra of some sort, throws it into the air in triumph, and the camera shows that thigh bone as it's flying through the air, rotating, 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 and in a few seconds it morphs into a rotating space station. Okay, you may remember that stunning image, right? It's from the beginning of Stanley Kubrick's 2001, which is now, of course, a decade ago. But in that, I think, really stunning image, you really see in many ways what my thesis is, what I'm going to propose, which is that the transition between human beings as primarily biological creatures to human beings as primarily culturally driven creatures, or at least creatures who live and operate within a world of culture, and of course science and technology, although that's just one component of culture, that dichotomy, that therein lies in some ways some of the most exciting and wonderful and hopeful things about being human, but I think also therein lie some of our greatest problems. In that disparity, essentially, between our biological selves and our cultural selves. And that's why I suggested titling this talk The Hare and the Tortoise, with the hare being culture and the tortoise being biology, and the disparity between the two, as far as I'm concerned, being a major, not the only driver, but a major driver of a large proportion of the problems that I think human beings experience. So that, again, let me reiterate this, that we are all the products of biological evolution. We're a species just like any other. Maybe I shouldn't say just like any other. Every species is different in its own way, and we're different in our own ways too, but we are also biological species, whatever else we are. So, but at the same time that we are the products of biological evolution, the tortoise plodding along at a Darwinian pace, we are also enmeshed in cultural evolution, which progresses almost by definition at an enormously more rapid pace, and hence the hare. Another way to look at it is that we're all time travelers, essentially, with one foot stuck in our biological past and one foot stuck in our cultural present. And the spread between them is growing wider and wider. And not surprisingly, I guess it's a rather uncomfortable stance to be in. And getting more uncomfortable, I think, all the time. One can make a case, although I'm not prepared to do this right now, but I think one could make a case that we're the only animal species that is truly out of place in its own environment. To some extent, you could make this argument for other animals insofar as people have changed the environments in which those animals live. But if you look at the behavior, the biology of animals living their own lives in their own environments, especially when that environment has not been manipulated by people, there's some sense in which they're doing what they evolved to do. In the case of humans, it's a much more complicated and more difficult and, I would say, awkward situation. Insofar as, again, those two fundamental processes, biological evolution and cultural evolution, have, I think, become somewhat disconnected from each other. Imagine two people. There was an old movie a long time ago, I think it was called The Defiant Ones or something, about a black man and a white man who were chained together. You can think in those terms. Think about human beings as being essentially made up of a hare and a tortoise chained together. There's a lot of drama, I think, that derives from that. One more, let me give you another metaphor, another image, is that I think we're all afflicted in some ways with a kind of evolutionary hangover now in the 21st century. Essentially consequences of what we did or what we were for that 99.999% of our biological past that essentially made us as Homo sapiens, and the difference between that and the circumstance in which we find ourselves today. All right, so we have biological evolution, which is, again, as far as we understand it, and I think we understand it really quite well in this regard, a slow-moving process. It cannot proceed more rapidly than one generation at a time. And people talk about, well, they may say, well, my ideas have evolved or what have you, and that's a perfectly good metaphor, but what they really mean is my ideas have changed. Evolution and change are not exactly the same thing. You can change in many ways, and you haven't really evolved in the biological sense. A lineage evolves, a genotype, taken in the larger sense, evolves. Evolution really involves changes in genetic makeup of a lineage over time, and that can't happen in anything more rapid than one generation. Indeed, one generation is absurd. It takes many, many, many generations, thousands, tens of thousands, depending on what sort of trait you're talking about, but we're talking about a huge amount of time for even a small change, as far as we know in almost all cases, evolutionarily, when it's biological evolution. But when it's cultural evolution, it really needs to be emphasized, the rate of change is dramatically different. Here we're not talking about a change in the makeup of the DNA, the underlying DNA of a lineage at all. We're talking about the very rapid, often very rapid changes that happen extragenically, essentially, or extragenetically. I'm not sure which is the appropriate adverb here. Another way of thinking about it, whereas biological evolution is Darwinian in that it was really Darwin who basically helped us understand how natural selection works, cultural evolution is essentially Lamarckian. And most of you may well remember Lamarck. I think he gets something of a bad rap, to be honest. Not that he was right. In most cases, in fact, as far as we know, he was wrong. But this is kind of the way he's remembered, is, you know, he was the guy who was wrong. And what Lamarck described is often repeated in the shorthand, the inheritance of acquired characteristics. The idea that an organism acquires a certain trait, the classic one is something like the giraffe supposedly got a long neck by stretching it to try to reach leaves, and so it passed on its longer neck to its offspring. Well, that's not the way evolution works. We know that you acquire, when you acquire a characteristic in your lifetime, that doesn't mean that your offspring are going to be any more likely to inherit it unless there's been some change in your genes that you acquire, maybe through mutation would be the main force. So Lamarck was generally wrong as insofar as the inheritance of acquired characteristic was supposed to explain biological evolution. But in fact, it very well explains cultural evolution. People acquire a characteristic, a language, a way of doing things, an attitude towards something, and any number of things, a way of dressing, a cultural tradition, whatever it may be, and they may modify it or not and then pass it along to someone else. And it doesn't require any change in the genome at all. Okay, and one consequence of that, of course, is that it can happen very, very rapidly. Unlike biological evolution, which again requires many generations to take effect. I mean, any number of examples. Think about something like computers, which a lot of people think about these days. Well, there's some debate as to when the computer was really invented. You know, there were conceptions of computers that happened quite a long time ago. There was the Turing machine. There was all sorts of stuff in the late 40s. Some sort of bona fide computers in many ways were actually operating in the early 50s. They were huge. It took a room this size, literally wouldn't contain one one-thousandth of the computing power that's right there on that little laptop, for instance. Right now, I don't know the data on how many people use computers on a daily basis. I would be surprised if it's fewer than a billion. I imagine maybe 2 or 3 billion, maybe more than that. Now, if a computer, the computer, was invented biologically as a result of some sort of genetic mutation or series of mutations and recombinations, et cetera, say in the late 40s, how many people would be using computers today? You know, maybe a dozen or two dozen if a person was unusually prolific. Clearly, that's not the way it's worked. Things have progressed at a probably more rapid than geometric rate. And I think that's a model for how, maybe it's an exaggerated model in some cases, but sometimes things progress even more rapidly than that. Who had heard of Barack Obama, you know, 10 years ago? And now he's probably the most famous person in the world, and probably deservedly so. But so things happen very rapidly in the cultural sphere without any requirement for genetic change. Okay. Now let me relate that back to my main thesis before I give you some specific examples of how I think this problem manifests itself. I want to ask you to try to engage in what in German they would call a Gedanken experiment, simply a thought experiment. Okay, let's imagine that you took some newborn infants from Portland, Maine, and you transferred them back 50,000 or 150,000 years ago to the African savanna during the Pleistocene, and you had those infants grow up there, okay? Or sort of early Cro-Magnon man and woman in Europe, let's say maybe 50,000 or 70,000 years ago. They would almost certainly do just fine. They would grow up to be probably undistinguished, just because anyone else, and there's a random sample, members of their society, on average, probably no better or no worse than the others, and they would adapt, and not so much the evolutionary as the immediate sense, and do a perfectly good job. And the likelihood is that if you made a comparable switch, sort of time machine switch the other way, the same thing would happen. You could take some early Cro-Magnon infants, bring them up in Portland, and you know they'd probably grow up to proudly go to the University of New England and would not be considered unusual or out of place. And they wouldn't be out of place. Okay. Now, try to imagine making the same sort of switch among adults. All right, among functioning adults of a Cro-Magnon or Pleistocene East African society and that of modern Portland. And there's no way these individuals would be able to make it. They would be grotesquely out of place, not just a little bit out of place, but it's unimaginable how out of place they would be in either direction. Okay. The point I'm trying to make is that our biology essentially has not changed. You can identify, actually, some people are looking at certain small changes in certain enzyme function and what have you in even as little as 8,000 years, according to some. But these are really at very much at the margins compared to the changes that have gone on in terms of cultures, okay, in terms of human culture because of that rate. Now, admittedly, and I may be anticipating, or I hope to anticipate, some of your objections here. One can argue, and I think it's true, that the capacity for culture is itself a biological adaptation. And so in that sense, the distinction I'm making is somewhat arbitrary and artificial. Nonetheless, the fact that the capacity for culture is an adaptation, and in fact is probably the most important human adaptation, doesn't mean that the two, biology and culture, are necessarily synchronized. Indeed, I don't think there's much question that cultural evolution has taken off pretty much on its own almost entirely unmoored from the biological evolution that originally spawned it. Okay. Now, in Aesop's fable, you probably remember, it's the tortoise who wins, right? The hare is kind of dim-witted and ditzy and overconfident and easily distracted, thinking he's got it made all along, and at the last minute discovers that the tortoise has just kept plodding along, and he puts on a last-minute burst of speed, but he can't win. So there's a lesson there, a moral lesson, I suppose. But in reality, of course, we can't really ask, and I think it's important not to ask who's winning or who's going to win, because they're both us. Okay, we're not in a position to go, neener, neener, we beat the hare or we beat the tortoise. And that's part of the problem, is that they really are both us. And we have to, I think, in order to deal with that problem, we have to understand it first. And it may be easier, I fear, to understand the problem, which is what I'm trying to do, than it is to prescribe what to do about it. Okay. Now, again, I want to point out that in reality there is, there certainly can be, and often is considerable harmony between cultural evolution and biological evolution. Actually, E.O. Wilson used the phrase a while ago that biology keeps culture on a leash, which I think is maybe a little bit of an unfortunate phrase in that it emphasizes the restraining component, perhaps too much, but the truth is there is a real sense in which biology does restrain the options, the cultural options we might have, in certain ways that maybe so obvious that we don't even think about it. I mean, there, you could say, well, human beings are the products. There are many, in fact, who deny, sort of the biology deniers, not necessarily evolution deniers, but those who deny the role of biology in influencing our behavior, who would suggest that, well, people are free because of their cultures to do anything they want, to live any way they want. Well, that's really not true. I mean, there is no culture, for instance, in which people are constrained because of cultural tradition to sleep for only 1 hour a day or not to sleep at all. Okay? There is no culture in which people are constrained to eat 18 meals a day. And there's no culture in which people are constrained not to eat at all. I mean, these are absurd. We know, obviously, you can't defy biology that much, and that's the point. That's part of what we mean when you say that culture, biology keeps culture on a leash. There are certain limits. Some of those limits are more interesting than others. The fact that there are no cultures in which people don't eat isn't terribly interesting, although it may help to clarify the issue. It's more interesting that there are, for instance, no cultures in which men do more fathering than women do mothering. That gets a little more controversial and perhaps more interesting as well. But that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, is that biology influences culture. It provides basic patterns within which culture then proceeds to embroider any number of interesting variants, but they're always nonetheless variants within certain limits. Okay? And in that sense, I hope that what I'm saying is appropriate for a talk for the Center for Global Humanities, because part of what the humanities are concerned about has to do with, you know, what it is that makes us human, and also what it is, or should be, I think, perhaps somewhat more concerned with what are some of those constraints as well, because that's part of what makes us human, is the constraints, and recognizing that it's not a world of literally infinite possibilities. And indeed, I would go further, that's my point, and say that part of the problem, big problem we have, is that it's when culture and biology often conflict that we often have problems. Now, another little warning here before I get more specific. Let me clarify what I'm not saying, okay? I'm not saying that all human problems derive from this conflict between biological and cultural evolution. I think one can identify human problems that come from other sources. I simply think this is a major component that underlies a great deal of our problems and helps clarify our thinking, perhaps. I'm aware there's a risk. There's that notion that, you know, when you have a hammer, or a particularly good hammer, or if all you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail, you know. And so you know, I think this looking at the world, the human problems in that context is a pretty good hammer. But I don't mean to interpret everything as a nail, okay? But I am going to look at those things where we can maybe nail down a few things. So let me be a little more specific and talk about what I think is the greatest single human problem, although by no means is it the only one, which is namely the problem of violence. If you look at the history of human violence, among other things, it is the history of ever-increasing efficiency of killing, killing in ever-increasing numbers with ever-increasing ease, less and less literal mechanical effort required to achieve the maiming and killing of larger and larger numbers of people. And I would include killing in the sense of destroying or doing violence to the natural environment as well, okay, and to other animals too. But if you look, let's look specifically at violence literally toward other human beings. We don't know the exact sequence of various killing weaponry, but it's not a bad guess to talk about things like rocks and then clubs, maybe Kubrick's thigh bone of an extinct zebra of some sort of club, spears, bows and arrows, dart guns, muskets, first front-loading or breech-loading muskets, and front-loading muskets and breech-loading muskets, and you know, you could make a list, machine guns and submarines and all sorts of weapons of mass destruction, culminating, of course, in nuclear weapons, not least, and not trivially by any means. During that time of this extraordinarily rapid evolution, and I'll say evolution of killing weaponry, bearing in mind this is cultural evolution, we are the same critters, biologically, who killed each other with clubs and spears and rocks, as now stand poised to kill each other with nuclear weapons and do so with high explosives. We are the same biological critters, but our culture, and obviously I'm talking about culture to mean something other than simply art, music, opera, dance, etc., although I would include that certainly in culture too. But our culture, defined more broadly, has permitted us, has given us the tools to do this, and yet the us is the same us that existed 50,000 years ago. Now, I think, an important argument here, and I want to bring in one of the fathers of my own original field of training, which is ethology, animal behavior, and this is Konrad Lorenz, who was honored with the Nobel Prize, along with Nico Tinbergen and a fellow named Carl von Frisch in 1973. And Lorenz did a great deal to initiate the biological study of animal behavior. And one of his points is an important one that he made, and it turns out to have been somewhat exaggerated, but it's basically valid nonetheless. And his point was, and I think is still valid, as I said now, to a large extent, when we look at animals that are capable of killing each other, based on their biological attributes, we find that they very, very rarely do so. By contrast, animals that do not have the basic anatomy of convenient death, of visiting conveniently death upon a conspecific, are in fact much more likely to do so when inappropriate circumstances arise, largely because they lack the inhibitions against doing so. I'll give you some examples. He talked specifically about wolves, and it turns out that he was somewhat wrong there. By the way, subsequent studies have shown that wolves do kill each other, although not as often as some people would have thought, but more often than Lorenz did. But basically his point was that, and this does happen in wolves, and I've spent time studying wolves, and it really is true, that when a dominant wolf succeeds in demonstrating his dominance, and usually it's a he, although sometimes females do this too, over a subordinate, the subordinate will behave in a way that would seem quite peculiar, but think about dogs, and even domesticated dogs do something like this. The wolf will typically turn its neck and expose the subordinate wolf, and expose what is actually the most vulnerable part of its body, the jugular vein, the ventral part of its neck. And you can literally see the, sometimes you watch these conferences, you can see the vein pulsing right under the skin. And the dominant will be right over it and will not uncommonly snap its jaws right above that neck, but that's it. It's done its thing, it's shown its position, the subordinate has indicated subordination, and everything's pretty much hunky-dory after that. They know who's alpha and who's beta. Now, if they're from different packs, and depending on circumstances, sometimes, in fact, things go further than that. Nonetheless, wolves have this amazing, they're very, very potentially lethal creatures, and yet, interestingly, they do not typically engage in sort of intra-group murder. Give you another example that's where there are no exceptions to my knowledge. You look at something like rattlesnakes. Now, it turns out that a rattlesnake is not immune to another rattlesnake's venom. If a rattlesnake bites another rattlesnake, the victim will die. Okay? Rattlesnakes fight with each other a lot, particularly the males fighting for the fair hand, whatever the appropriate metaphor would be of the female, okay? And the males will fight quite vigorously with each other, and when they do so, it's very characteristic, here's where maybe a little bit of PowerPoint would help, but the males will push against each other, and they'll raise themselves up off the ground in doing so. And by the way, that's the caduceus symbol that, for reasons I do not understand, was adopted by the medical profession. So you see that image. The winner, eventually, one will push the other one over. And the one who gets pushed over has lost and goes slithering off, and the winner wins. But no one bites anyone, and no one dies. Okay. By contrast, if you were to put, ironically, it's a good way to look at this, you were to put two doves in a cage together, and doves are, of course, the classic symbol of peace. You were to put two doves in a cage together, especially two male doves, if they didn't know each other to begin with, there's a very good chance that one would kill the other, okay, eventually. And moreover, they would do so in a way that's, and this is interesting too, it's not just grotesque but interesting, they would do so in a way that's exceptionally bloody and prolonged and violent and altogether yucky. And the reason it is altogether yucky and prolonged is because they're not very good at it. Okay, they don't have poison, they don't have big fangs, so for one dove to kill another takes a very long time, and they literally just produce so many injuries on the other that the victim bleeds to death. Now, in nature, that wouldn't happen, because in nature, the subordinate would simply fly away once it's lost its battle. And doves don't have a behavioral repertoire that includes inhibition against killing, largely because they didn't need it. Because not only would the loser be able to fly away, but because they are not poisonous, they don't have big fangs, they don't have talons. And so, unlike, say, wolves or rattlesnakes, they have not been equipped by evolution with any inhibitory mechanisms. So, let's look a little bit very quickly at human beings. Where are we in this scheme? Well, we are much more like doves in terms of our biology. I've never conducted an experiment in this, like another sort of Gedanken thing, but I would venture to say that it's really very difficult for a naked, unarmed, untrained human being to kill another one. We are not well equipped to murder our fellows, all right? I mean, we don't have claws. Our jaws are ridiculous. They're sort of laughable, you know. They don't even stick out like a self-respecting mammal is supposed to. It would be very difficult, time-consuming, incredibly inefficient for a human to kill another human, lacking various cultural appurtenances. But as we just talked about, we have all sorts of cultural appurtenances, starting off with rocks and stones, and now nuclear weapons. So that my point is that biologically we're built like doves, and biologically I think we're built like doves in terms of our relative insensitivity and immunity to inhibitory mechanisms that keep us from killing each other because we didn't need it for 99.99% of our evolution. That hardly ever happened. Or when it did happen, it was inefficient and it happened in very, very small numbers. Okay? But now, suddenly, in evolutionary terms, biological evolutionary terms, but essentially overnight in other ways, we've become wolves or rattlesnakes. maybe to make it a more unpleasant metaphor, because we now have the ability, the equivalent of the rattlesnake's fangs, but because this is a newly evolved thing, evolved culturally, not biologically, we don't have any of the biologically given inhibitory tendencies. Or if we do, they're mild. They're not sufficiently developed. And even if they were, imagine there's not much opportunity for them to be expressed. If you're in a bomber 30,000 feet above your potential victims, if they were engaging in some biologically given subordination behavior, you wouldn't even know it, okay? Or if you're sitting in North America or anywhere else about to order the use of nuclear weapons and you don't even see your victims. So even if they had inhibitory subordination behaviors, our technology has rendered them essentially ineffective just because of distance, okay? And not to mention numbers. So, and again, I think, by the way, this is part of a big problem with regard to weaponry and human evolution and culture and biology. I think it says a lot about why guns are so dangerous. How am I doing for time? It's not that long ago since we had that horrible Virginia Tech killing and any number of events subsequent. That essentially the reason guns are so dangerous is that they're designed for killing, and moreover, they're designed for killing as essentially force multipliers, so that the amount of energy one has to expend in order to release an enormous amount of kinetic energy is very, very low. I don't know what the latest thing is for sort of hair triggers or even normal triggers, but it's got to be no more than ounces of pressure required to release a huge amount of energy. There's no doubt that you could kill somebody with a toaster oven, right, or a ping pong bat, but it's not very efficient. By contrast, there are things that are made specifically and designed to achieve that. And I think the danger is that facilitates this disparity, this override between our culture and our biology. And let me be more specific in the world of nuclear weapons, which in fact has been a concern of mine and my wife's for quite a long time, and probably for many of you too. I think the disconnect between culture and biology is particularly acute here, if only because the potential for destruction on a scale that greatly exceeds anything that a handgun could achieve is certainly there. As already revealed, of course, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and no one really, I think, questions that potential. Let me give you another sort of animal metaphor and way of thinking, particularly about nuclear weapons. At the one-year anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, Albert Einstein sent a very famous telegram, to the major physicists of the world. And as part of that telegram, he said, the splitting of the atom has changed everything except our way of thinking, and hence we drift toward unparalleled catastrophe. Okay. Now hold that in your mind for a minute. Let me tell you a story about muskoxen, which are among my favorite critters. Muskoxen, again, I think PowerPoint would probably be helpful here, but I know if I started using it, I'd rely on it too much, so I'm restraining myself. All right, so muskoxen look like great bison of the northern, of the Arctic tundra, okay? Sort of big shaggy bison. They have large bony foreheads and sharp horns, and they're big. When they're approached by predators, and for eons, the only predators that could make any inroads into muskoxen society were wolves. When they were approached by wolves, they would form a sort of a classic defensive maneuver whereby they basically, the adults would array themselves like the spokes of a wheel facing out, and the babies would be inside. Okay, and that's very effective. If you're a wolf, and you maybe weigh 100 pounds, 150 pounds if you're a big wolf, there you are approaching any way you try to get at these babies. There's no way you could take down an adult anyhow, probably, but the way you'd be able to approach the babies, you have to deal with the adults first, and there's just one head or another facing you. So you've got this bony shield, sharp horns, backed up by about 1,000 pounds of angry muskox pot roast, And you're not going to get very far. Okay? And muskox did this for thousands of generations, as far as we know, and they did it very effectively. But now, in recent years, that things have changed. The primary predator in muskox are no longer wolves. You doubtless know who they are. They're us, Homo sapiens, riding what the people up there call snow machines with high-powered hunting rifles. Okay? So what do the muskox do when they're approached by this new major terrestrial predator? Well, they do the same damn thing they've always done. You know, it's worked in the past. It's part of their biology. They form this defensive, this wonderful defensive system with all the adults facing out and the babies inside, and they all get killed. It's the worst thing you could possibly do when you've got people on snow machines with high-powered hunting rifles. It doesn't defend you at all. What should they do? I don't know. I suppose they should just run like hell. If they just took off over the horizon, probably some of them would survive. As it is, the only musk oxen now are endangered, an endangered species, and they're not actively hunted anymore, but that's just because humans have intervened to save them from other humans. My point is that musk ox do what is part of their biological evolution and what has always been appropriate as part of their biological evolution, but that now they are confronted with something new, cultural evolution, the hare, not in terms of their own creations, but in terms of our creations, and they continue to do what they always did, which served them well in the past, but is lethal now. And so getting back to Einstein, you could say that the invention of the snow machine and the high-powered hunting rifle has changed everything but the musk ox's way of thinking. And hence it drifts toward unparalleled catastrophe, which indeed it does. Okay. And I think that's a big part of the problem. And for humans, specifically with regard to nuclear weapons or with regard to weaponry generally, but I think nuclear weapons more than anything, our way of thinking, just like the muskox's way of thinking, or maybe we should say not thinking, was formed during that, you know, 99.999% of its evolutionary history, when there was no reason for a response like running like heck over to the horizon would have been appropriate. It's the wrong thing to do when you're attacked by wolves, because the wolves could pull down the slower ones from behind and the babies. So it's the right thing to do with wolves, but the wrong thing to do under new cultural conditions. For humans, I think, again, when it comes to nuclear weapons, we think about them wrongly because we are in many ways like musk oxen. Okay? First of all, we hardly think about them at all. And one reason we hardly think about them is because they are so out of our biological ken. You know, we talk about something being, say, hot. What do we mean? You know, when you think about hot, well, there's a hot day, you know, it could be 80 degrees. I spent this past winter in Costa Rica where it was hot. You know, it was 90 degrees often, 95 degrees. That was hot, as far as I was concerned. Water can be hot. Boiling water is hot. It's 212 degrees Fahrenheit, you know. A fire can be hot, 400 degrees, 500 degrees, you know. Molten metal, maybe, is hotter yet, 1,000, 2,000 degrees. But if I tell you, you know, that the inside of a explosion of a hydrogen bomb is 100 million degrees, what does that mean to you? It doesn't mean anything to me, really, other than a bunch of zeros. I cannot relate to that because my biological nature knows hot. But it sort of stops at about 1,000 degrees, and maybe even before that. It certainly doesn't go into that realm. And so I think the weapons, to some extent, are armored against our own perception because they go beyond our own biology. They're cultural creations for which our biology has really no frame of reference. Okay? And as a consequence, we have a hard time thinking accurately about them. There are many other things like that that pertain specifically to nuclear weapons. Numbers. You know, numbers are numbing. You know, a single death is a tragedy. Actually, Stalin said that. A single death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic. And as despicable as Stalin was and how he intended it, because it was really intended as a way of disparaging the importance of a million deaths. But the truth is, that's the way it works for human psychology. You know, the death of someone I know and love and care about is an enormous tragedy. You talk about the deaths of tens of millions, and I'm lost. And I'm sure I'm not unique in that regard. And so to some extent, we just don't think about these things. And that enables, to some extent, nuclear weapons themselves to go on almost as an independent hare for which the tortoise just is totally oblivious. Okay. There are a number of other examples of, in the nuclear realm, where I've actually wrote a whole book about that called The Caveman and the Bomb. We can go into that if anyone wants, but I think you get the point here. Let me go very quickly into just a few other examples, and then I'll conclude and try to leave time for questions, comments, what have you. Well, there are all sorts of examples. In fact, I don't really have time to go into them in the detail they deserve, but I'll just mention a few. Population. I think the overpopulation problem in the world is very much a function of the fact that our biological inclination to reproduce remains basically unchanged, whereas culturally we've changed things on the other end. We've exported death control. We've created death control via public health measures and hygiene, which I'm all in favor of. But at the same time as those cultural advances have happened, there has been nothing comparable by way of modifying the other side of the equation. And so we tend to operate as tortoises. You don't think of tortoises reproducing rapidly. We think of the hares as reproducing rapidly, so it's maybe a confusing metaphor, but I think you get my point. When it comes to environmental destruction, again, we are capable of destroying, you know, whole continents, whole planets, in a way that no other animal has been. And again, we have never been in a situation where we had that option. And we, as with weaponry, we don't have the inhibitions. Okay, at least not the biologically generated inhibitions. Let me give you a last example from daily life that is a little less fraught than nuclear weapons, perhaps. Okay, I'm thinking of our species-wide sweet tooth. Which admittedly isn't held by everybody, but certainly the overwhelming majority of us, and I plead guilty. Most people like sweets, all right? So we could ask, well, why? Well, why do we like sugar? Why do we like sugary things, sweet desserts, whatever, sweet drinks? Well, we like it because it's sweet, because it tastes good. So, but when asked, well, why? Why is sugar sweet? Well, the sweetness of sugar does not reside in the chemical makeup of glucose or sucrose or fructose. There's nothing inherently sweet about that. If you were to ask an anteater would probably say that sugar is not sweet at all. You know, kind of bitter or maybe uninteresting. But ants, wow, you know, ants are really sweet. Okay, so there's probably almost certainly something in formic acid that anteaters perceive as sweet, just like people perceive sugars that way. Well, why is that? Well, almost certainly, again, it's because we evolved as primates, of course, in trees where fruit was important, and fruit is a way that plants enrich their seed products and make them attractive to other animals, birds and mammals and primates. And so for primates, during this long period of our own evolution, it was adaptive for us to be positively inspired by sweetness because it meant it was ripe fruit and good for us. Okay. Now, of course, and that's our part of our biology again. Now, of course, because of our culture, we can provide ourselves with all sorts of sweets. The whole, you know, confectionery industry and chocolatiers and sweet drinks with nothing in them other than sweetness. And so our culture, our hair, the cultural hair, has provided us with the opportunity to take advantage of the susceptibility that our tortoise has, very much to our disadvantage. Now, this is not as serious as nuclear weapons by a long shot, but I think it has a lot to do with the obesity epidemic, for instance. Closely related to that, and I think a very comparable argument, have to do with fats. Again, our Pleistocene ancestors, for the great majority, 99%+ of our evolution, lived out on the African savanna, and they didn't just eat fruit. By that time, actually, they were eating a lot of meat as well, as far as we know. And when it comes to meat, game generally is not very fat, okay? There's relatively little fat. Any of you are hunters, you know, you don't get a lot of fat from game. When you do, it's a big treat, especially if you're a free-living animal, because fat is very concentrated, very high caloric density. But our ancestors didn't get to eat very much fat. And fat, when available, was a very efficient and, you know, glorious treat. But it didn't happen very often. Now, well, we can fatten up our cattle and our pigs and what have you in feedlots and make well-marbled steaks. And many, many, many people find that very, very attractive. Is it good for us? No. But it is a carryover from when eating of fat was highly adaptive and something we couldn't overdo anyhow. Now, of course, we can exaggerate it, just like with the case of sweets. And the result of not just obesity epidemic, but atherosclerosis and heart disease and cancers, perhaps, and all sorts of things. And let me add one other factor to this. When David was driving me around today, showing me some of the lovely parts of Portland, there are some wonderful areas for running, some great running tracks. I know a lot of people do that. But the great majority of people don't, okay? Now, our ancestors almost certainly got a whole lot more exercise than we do. As it is, we take elevators all over the place. We have all these labor-saving devices. We have to make special arrangements to go and run, you know, or join a gym. So add that to the problem of, you know, empty calories in the case of glucose, not to mention dental caries, but just calories, and add that to the fat problem as well. What I'm saying, add what to? Well, add the relative lack of exercise. There are a few fanatics like myself who get a lot of exercise, probably more than they should, but the great majority of people get significantly less than they should because culture has made it such that we no longer have to in order to get by in our lives. And I think we got a lot of problems. Again, it's one example of a problem, this sort of dietary phenomenon, which is kind of balances some of the overwhelming issues of something like nuclear weapons. Well, all right, what to do? I'm about to conclude here. First of all, I'm a biologist by training and inclination, but don't expect biology to ride to our rescue. Biology, as I said, is very slow. If we waited a couple thousand generations, perhaps we would get some sort of biologically mediated adaptations that would help us out. But at this point, I don't think there's much doubt that culture is the disparity between our biology and our culture that got us into much of this trouble. And it's the culture that is responsible, it's the disparity that's responsible. But it's culture that's capable of making rapid changes. That's part of what culture is. And that's where we have to look if we want to make changes. I would not countenance sitting back and saying, well, just wait, biology will solve that problem. It's really up to culture. In his second discourse, Jean-Jacques Rousseau made the very famous case that human beings are all noble savages who were corrupted by society. And so one could say that that's a little bit of the argument that I'm making. It's not, but it's close enough that I need to pick that up a little bit. I found it interesting that Rousseau was so proud of his essay. He was quite a bit younger than Voltaire, and he sent his copy of the essay to Voltaire, hoping for Voltaire's approval. And Voltaire wrote back as follows in English. He didn't write in English, I'm translating it for you. I have received, monsieur, your new book Against the Human Race. You paint in very true colors the horrors of human society. No one has ever employed so much intellect to persuade men to be beasts. In reading your work, one is seized with a desire to walk on all four paws. However, as it is more than 60 years since I lost that habit, I feel, unfortunately, that it is impossible for me to resume it. Well, I'm really not going to cross swords with Voltaire. I'm not arguing that we need to give up on culture and start walking on all four paws and become the biological critters, the tortoises that we were somehow meant to be. And we're clearly very much enmeshed with our culture. There's no way we could give up culture. Here I am speaking through a microphone. I'm admittedly not using PowerPoint, but you know, I flew out here. I use antibiotics when my kids get sick. When I get sick, I take advantage of all sorts of things that our culture provides, not to mention music and art and painting, etc., dance. And Rousseau himself actually acknowledged this, that we cannot give up on culture. And indeed, Freud and his Civilization and its Discontents, which makes an argument that's somewhat similar. He also pointed out that we're stuck with civilization. He saw it as sort of a tragic situation, but he did say we're stuck with civilization. There's no way we can go back. And I'm not arguing that we should give up on our culture so as to somehow be less violent. But I think we need to be aware of the problems that culture is providing and of the necessity on the part of cultural institutions to provide us with mechanisms to deal with this problem. So, as a concluding little story, let me offer the following. I don't want anyone to walk away from this talk with the impression that I'm saying that everything's hopeless. You know, we're stuck, we're sort of marionettes, helplessly dancing on the ends of the strings pulled by our DNA, because one might get a bit of that impression. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, in fact, we need to look to culture to make these changes. And I think there is reason to be hopeful that we can do that. But to make that argument, let me give you a very homey example, maybe even a homely example. I don't know how many of you have ever thought about, let's talk about toilet training. I don't know how many of you ever thought about why it is that dogs and cats can be so readily housebroken, whereas people take a whole lot longer and it's a big hassle, all right? You can housebreak a dog or a cat, and housebreak sounds like this sort of violent effort, but really they almost yearn to be housebroken. It's very easy to train a dog or a cat to pee or poop in the right place. People take, what, 3 years, 4 years? What's going on here? We are so much smarter than dogs or cats by just about every measure. Why is it so much harder for us? Well, I think a little bit of evolutionary thinking helps clarify this. Dogs and cats, of course, evolved in a two-dimensional world where it clearly was not in their interest to foul their den. And so they very readily, they've been provided by evolution with a very, very prompt learning capacity to learn where they should and where they shouldn't pee and poop. Primates, including human beings, of course, we evolved in the trees. Well, if you spent any time watching non-human primates in the trees, they're not housebroken or toilet trained. And indeed, you know, that's kind of a problem for those of us who live down below and maybe are looking up at them. They're, in fact, it's one of the reasons why monkeys make such terrible pets, in addition to the fact that they're really too smart to keep in a cage. You have to keep them in a cage because you can't housebreak them. Okay? Why can't you housebreak them? Because they're primates. They evolved in the trees. They don't do that, unlike dogs or cats. But where does that leave us then? Okay? Well, we're primates. Does that mean that it's hopeless? Well, look around you. I would venture to say everyone in this room is housebroken, toilet trained. Every one of you is toilet trained. And that's kind of a remarkable fact. A primate that's toilet trained? We're the only primate species that is. Or that's even toilet train a bull. Chimpanzees, you have to, even as smart as they are, you have to have diapers on them if you're going to have them in a, you know, a, sort of a laboratory situation. So I think my reason for mentioning it isn't just a fancy fondness for sort of off-color stories or something, but I think if we look at the fact that we are a species that is a primate species that's capable of being toilet trained, is, I think, a thing we should really be amazingly proud of, and we should take a great deal of confidence and maybe even wonder from in terms of our ability to modify some of our more deep-seated biologically given inclinations or sensibilities. So I guess what I want to do really is end with a sort of hopeful note that a species that can be housebroken could perhaps ultimately be, or can be house-trained, let's say, could ultimately be planet trained someday too. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.